Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I'm here to welcome you to the post-diet revolution. That means making peace with food without ever counting a single calorie, carb, or fat gram. I'll help you stop thinking about food all the time so you can focus on other things in your life. It really is possible to lose weight and gain health, all without ever going on another diet. If you'd like to join me today, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Feel free to call me and talk to me about whatever is going on in your mind, whether it's food, weight, and body image related, or whether it's something that's eating at you, because food is really not the problem. The problem is what's eating at you, not what you're eating. So last week, one of our regular callers, Brian from Chicago, called in and asked about black and white thinking, and that led us to a conversation about cognitive distortions. Those are ways of thinking that impact the way we experience ourselves, each other, and the world. The good news is that when we recognize the nature of this distorted way of thinking, we can change the way that we think. And when we change the way we think, everything changes. The way we see ourselves, each other, and the world also changes. So I thought that I would give you guys a more comprehensive list of these distortions, because I think they're really interesting, and I hope you will too. If you listened last week, you might hear some of the ones that I discussed with Brian, but it doesn't hurt to hear them more than once. So the first one is black and white thinking, also known as all or nothing thinking, polarized thinking. So it's a way, it manifests as an inability or unwillingness to see the color in between black and white. Can't use that phrase, shades of gray, anymore. Just has a whole other connotation. But I like color. I like to imagine that in between black and white is a whole color, a rainbow of color. That's much more compelling than shades of gray, which sounds kind of depressing. And like I say, whole other connotation. So if you have this way of thinking, you see things in terms of extremes. Something's either fabulous or it's awful. You're either perfect or you're a total failure. So there's a lot in between perfection and failure, and the key is to be able to look for that and find it. Second one is overgeneralization. So this sneaky little distortion takes one instance of something that happens or one example and generalizes it as an overall pattern. For example, your girlfriend, a boyfriend, partner, whoever might criticize you for one little thing, like, hey honey, can you not leave your laundry on the floor in the bathroom or whatever, and then you conclude that, you know, that person, that your relationship is in trouble, that everything's going to go wrong. So one little thing, like, here's a better example. That was an iffy example. I'm going to give you guys a better one. So you're a student and you get a C on one test, and then you conclude that you're stupid and a failure. Nothing is ever going to go right for you. Nothing will ever be good for you again. That one C gets overgeneralized to everything. And this can lead to overly negative thoughts about yourself based on only one or two experiences. So it's one to really watch out for. Well, they all are. Another one is called mental filter. So it's similar to overgeneralization. The mental filter distortion focuses on a single negative thing and excludes all the positive. So an example of this is if you're, I'm going to try this romantic relationship analogy example again. So if you're in a romantic relationship and your partner makes a single negative comment about you, then you start viewing the relationship as hopelessly lost while ignoring the years of positive comments or months or all the other positive comments and experiences that you've had. So it's like a way of filtering out the good and only letting the bad stick, or even the perceived bad. Another one is called disqualifying the positive. So disqualifying the positive distortion, when you do that, you acknowledge the positive experience, but you reject them instead of letting them in and truly embracing them and letting them stick. So, for example, a person who receives a positive review at work might reject the idea of being competent and a valued employee and attribute this positive review to political correctness or to the boss just not wanting to deal with other employment performance problems. Again, I hear this all the time. If I say anything, you know, positive to a patient, they tell me, "Oh, you're just saying that because you have to." Which, by the way, I don't have to. I only speak the truth. So, or people say, "Well, my parents tell me that, you know, I'm wonderful," but that's because they're my parents. I mean, they have to. They don't see me correctly. So it's a really harmful distortion, because it makes you continue this negative thought pattern about yourself even when there is lots of evidence to the contrary. So it's just a way of totally dismissing anything good. And again, you want to be able to watch for that and let the good in, let the good stick. Another one is called jumping to conclusions or mind reading. This is the inaccurate belief that we know what another person is thinking. Now, of course, it is possible to have an idea of what other people are thinking, but this is a distortion that refers to the negative interpretations that we jump to, the negative conclusions we jump to when we think we are reading someone's mind. So seeing a stranger with kind of an unpleasant expression, and jumping to the conclusion that she's thinking something negative about you is an example, instead of thinking, wow, that person's having a bad day, or that person has resting bitch face. Oh, my gosh. I had one person tell me, I shifted in my chair because my back hurt or something, and the person said, "Ugh, I see how you're shifting in your chair. You hate me. You can't wait to get away from me. You want to get up out of that chair and run out of the room," when actually my back hurt. So that would be an example of jumping to conclusions. Here's another form of jumping to conclusions: fortune telling. Now, fortune telling is the tendency to make conclusions and predictions based on little to no evidence and holding them as the absolute truth, as if you have a crystal ball. So an example is a lot of people go on dates. They're trying to find the love of their lives. They go on dates. These dates are bad. These dates are tragic. These dates are horrible. Oh my God, one of my first dates, I go on this date and we go to the movies. You can't even believe this. I got to tell you this. We go to the movies, and my date, and I'm in high school, and my date was in college at MIT. So very smart, but very not smart, because this is what he did. Someone had left a carton of popcorn underneath the seat in front of us in the movies, and I guess the cleaning crew hadn't seen it. My date goes, "Ooh, free popcorn," and starts eating the popcorn. Oh my God, can you believe it? And that's not even the worst date I ever had, but it's a pretty funny one. So jumping to conclusions, fortune telling would be like me saying, "Oh my God, there are no normal men out there. This is freaking weird, and I am never going to find Mr. Right. I am never going to have the right guy in my life. I'm never going to find love. I'm going to be single and unhappy forever. So fortune telling is like having a bad experience and thinking that you're never going to have a good experience just based on the fact that you haven't had it yet. So people see these instances as a prediction of fact, as if they have a crystal ball, a prediction of fact rather than one of several possible outcomes. I mean, if you go on a horrible date and you go on a succession of them, I suppose it is possible that you will never find love, but it is also very possible that it's a numbers game and you will find the right person for you. So beware of having your fears feel like your fortune. Another one is called magnification or minimization. So this is sort of two in one. So it's a way of skewing your perspective. It involves exaggerating the importance or meanings of some things and minimizing the importance or meanings of other things. So someone who is an athlete, who's generally a good player, but makes one mistake, may magnify that mistake and make it into, oh my God, I'm a bad player, I'm a bad teammate, I'm the team's gonna lose because of me. While another athlete who, say, wins an award may minimize the award and believe, oh, I'm only a mediocre player. It's sort of a form of mental filter, but it's when, you know, big things are minimized, achievements are minimized, and little mistakes are magnified. All right, I'm just going to keep going because there are a lot of them, but I think they're really important when you start realizing that you have a way of thinking that, hey, it may not actually be true. You may be viewing the world in a kind of distorted way. You learned this way of thinking. But when you question it and challenge it and change it, then, hey, you know what? You get an award and you're going to feel good about yourself. You go on a bad date and you go, nah. And you know, someone tells you a compliment. You say, oh, thank you. And you take it in. Like, the world is just so much a better place. But if you have anything that's on your mind, I would love to hear from you. 818-602-4929. All right. Another cognitive distortion is called emotional reasoning. Now, the logic behind this distortion is not surprising. It's the realization that almost all of us have brought in this distortion at time to time that is kind of striking. Emotional reasoning refers to the acceptance of one's emotion as fact. It can be described as, I feel it, therefore it must be true. Now, we intellectually and rationally know this isn't a reasonable belief, but it is very common. So if someone, for example, feels rejected, that does not mean, because of an interpretation of something that's happened, that does not mean you have actually been rejected. Very common. When you take your feelings as facts, your feelings are an interpretation and a reaction to a situation, but they may trick you. They may not be what's actually going on. Oh, here's one of my favorites, should statements. This is just such a pervasive and such a terrible way to think in the world. Should statements are statements you make to yourself about what you should do, what you ought to do, what you must do. It's often I should do this or I shouldn't have done that. And when we hang on too tightly to our should statements, the result is like this guilt that we didn't do what we think we should have done. And when we do that, we just feel guilty and bad about ourselves instead of, hey, don't should on yourself. Instead of that, ask yourself, well, you know, what do you want to do? What do you not want to do? You should be a a person who lives in a way that is moral, and you should take care of yourself and others, period. The shoulds that are applied to, oh, I shouldn't have eaten that, or I should really make healthier choices, or I should spend time with my friends, but I kind of don't want to, and now I feel bad about myself. Those are the ones that you want to pay attention to. So instead of saying, I should, just ask yourself what you want and what do you want to do? What do you not want to do? And pay attention to that and value that instead of giving yourself a hard time with these should statements. Okay, another one. Labeling and mislabeling. These are basically extreme forms of overgeneralization in which we assign judgments of value to ourselves or to others based on one instance or one experience. For example, someone who calls herself an utter idiot for not completing an assignment at work is engaging in this kind of distortion. Or like, say, a server who doesn't appropriately get thanked by a customer and then says, oh, that customer is the worst. What a nasty customer. That person should have thanked me better. So mislabeling refers to applying highly emotional, loaded language when labeling. So it's extreme. It's not like, oh, you know, I wish that person would have thanked me for whatever I did. It becomes, that person didn't thank me, and that makes them a bad, nasty person. Or, I made this mistake, and that makes me a mistake. That makes me just an idiot, a failure, just, I'm the worst because of something tiny. Personalization. As the name implies, this distortion involves taking everything personally or assigning blame to yourself with no logical reason to believe you're actually to blame. This distortion covers a wide range of situations, from assuming you're the reason, like say you go out with a bunch of friends and one of your friends is kind of quiet. And like there's five of you out to dinner and one of your friends is quiet and you're like, oh, it's my fault. Somehow like I failed to make her happy. That you take full responsibility for the moods and feelings of others when maybe your friend just was up all night with a baby and like, or maybe she's depressed or maybe she's going through something. So personalization can be something like that, or it can be believing that you're the cause of every instance of moodiness or irritation in people around you. Okay, I will give you an example of my own life where I was guilty of personalization. So when I was first with my husband, in the morning, he would be what I thought was grumpy, very grumpy. He just like, he wasn't very talkative. He just was quiet. To me, he seemed like he was in a terrible mood. And I was like, oh my God, what have I done? What did I say last night? What's going on? And I came to find out, because I asked him, you're in a bad mood. You seem like you're in a bad mood. What did I do? He's like, I'm not in a bad mood. I just don't wake up. And he doesn't drink coffee, which is, I don't understand it. He must be from another planet. He does not drink coffee. So he takes a while to wake up. And before he's awake, he's sort of flatline, which I personalized as being mad at me. So that is an example of personalization. Control fallacy. A control fallacy manifests as one of two beliefs. One, that we have absolutely no control over our lives. We are helpless victims of fate. Or two, that we are in complete control of ourselves and our lives, giving us responsibility for the feelings and well-being of those around us. So both beliefs are very damaging and both are very inaccurate. No one is in complete control of what happens to them. And no one has absolute control over their situation. No, absolutely no control over this. No one's in complete control, and no one has absolutely no control. Even in extreme situations where you seemingly have no choices in what you do, where you go, what you say, you still have a certain amount of control over how you approach the situation mentally. So that's something to keep in mind. You know, it has to do with helplessness. And this is often something that ties into food, because when we feel helpless over a situation in our lives, often we turn to food and use food for comfort or distraction or for numbing, and then say, oh, look, I have no control over what I'm eating. Now, ostensibly, you can have control over what you're eating, which is why there's a displacement from having a sense of not having control in your life to not having control over food. It gives you that sense of, oh, wait, you know, maybe I can't control what my boss says or what my boyfriend says or girlfriend or kid or whoever. I can't control them, but I can control what I eat or don't eat. And so you focus on that instead of dealing with what's really upsetting you and making you feel helpless. Another one is the fallacy of fairness. It's really a bummer, because I really want to believe in the fallacy of fairness. So what that is, you know, you want to believe that the world is fair. You mean it isn't? What? This assumption is not based in reality, unfortunately, and it can foster negative feelings when we're faced with proof that life can be random and unfair. So a person who judges every experience by its perceived fairness has fallen for this fallacy. What alliteration? Can I say this without saying an F? Oh, wait, hold on. Here's a caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show.
Hey, Dr. Nina. It's Brian from Chicago. How are you?
Hi, Brian. And Brian from Chicago. Yeah. Nice to hear from you again.
I respond to both of those.
How are you? What's going on?
I'm doing well. So here's my question. I've got these weekly questions, and sometimes I feel like they're variations on the same theme I'm always asking you about, but it just feels good to have a little bit of either validation or a little bit of guidance on this. So I think from our past conversations, you know that I like getting to the gym very frequently. You know, at least 6 days, but sometimes I'll go every single day if I possibly can. And on the days that I don't, I feel, you know, I'm on a scale of either I feel a little bit sloth-like all the way to sometimes it feels like the day is ruined. And going to the gym just kind of makes me feel better about life in general. So my question is it, and this is a sort of a subjective thing, I know, but is it okay to feel that way, or is that obsessive?
Well, you're asking me a couple of different things. Is it okay to go to the gym 6 days a week? Is it okay to feel that way when you don't go to the gym?
I think more the latter. I mean, whether it's, you know, okay going to the gym is more like, you know, hey, as long as you're not hurting yourself, why not? But it's really more like, is it okay, or is it on the spectrum of, you know, relatively not problematic, or is it more towards the obsessive side to feel bad if I don't get there?
Well, I think that you just introduced an example of overgeneralization. So if I don't get to the gym, I feel bad about myself. And if I do get to the gym, the world is a better place, right? That mm-hmm. going to the gym is very loaded. Like, you know, what makes right. the world a better place if you go to the gym? So the answer to your question is in how you feel. If going to the gym gives you that much sense of, wow, the world is all is well with the world, and if not going makes you feel that bad about yourself, that's the problem. You know, that mm-hmm. So I would say that, you know, what is it about going to the gym? Is that your way of making yourself feel safe in the world? So if you go, things are good. You tell me.
Well, I'll put it this way. I've heard you on past shows. You've used this analogy, which I've turned around and used quite a bit because I just found it to be very true and very, very applicable. That, you know, you can get in your car and you're out in LA. So I don't know exactly offhand like what your freeways are, but you get in your car and you get on whatever the highway or the freeway is. And if your mood is all LA drivers are just rude and they don't let you in and they try to cut you off and they speed up, then you're going to see evidence of that everywhere you look on your drive. But if you get in the car and instead your outlook that day is, you know, people try to do what they can. They may not always be able to let me in, but they try. Then you're going to see evidence of that too. So for me, I think going to the gym just puts me into more of the second frame of mind. It tends to make me feel good, and therefore my perception of the world is from a better place than if I don't get to the gym and I start feeling a little blah, and then my perception of the world is more like, you know, all you drivers are awful. So I think it's kind of almost like a self-medicating thing to just, it makes me feel better about everything. So since it's not a harmful thing to do, it's not like I'm saying, you know, if I don't get at least one hit off the crack pipe, I don't feel good. It's really just going to the gym. Is it okay? Or is it symptomatic of something that I should be looking more closely at?
Well, as you say, it could be worse. You could be on the crack pipe, which would not be good. Mm-hmm. But what you're mm-hmm. saying is you're not just feeling good because you're working out. You're feeling good about yourself and the world. And when you don't go, you feel like the world, like there's a dark cloud over the world, almost the way you describe it. And In a sense, being able to go to the gym and have a good positive worldview is not a bad thing. But I would just hope that you can look at that a little more closely and find a way to feel good about yourself and the world without having to go and do whatever it is you do in the gym. Well, you know, mm-hmm. without having to go lift weights or run on a treadmill or whatever. That you've found like sort of a positive means of affecting the way that you feel about yourself in the world and the world, but mm-hmm. the fact that you don't feel good if you don't go is not good. You want to be able to, if you get sick, for example, and you can't go to the gym,
right.
You know, you don't want to feel sick and then feel bad about yourself in the world. You have to have a way of feeling mm-hmm. decently without doing something, just
right.
an attitude that's there no matter what.
But I think, you know, for me, it's not as if, you know, all things being equal between the days I go to the gym and the days I don't, the gym and whether I'm there alone has the power to transform my perception of the day from it's a good day to it's a bad day. It's really more like, you know, life has stresses. There's work, there's family, there's commute, there's, you know, everything is kind of rush, there's kind of the world that we're living in right now, and I certainly don't want to bring politics up in connection with this show, but kind of wherever you are on the spectrum, it's hard out there, and so there's stresses that are just kind of always around, like this ambient noise. So if everybody kind of has their normal stresses during the day, then I think it's just that going to the gym, for me, allows me to kind of break through those stresses and just feel good, as opposed to if I don't get to the gym and it's just those stresses without the relief of the gym, then I can feel the stresses more acutely. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you have found a good way of managing your stress and relieving your stress, which is one thing. But as long as it ends there and it's not about, oh, now the world doesn't feel as good,
right,
then mm-hmm. that would be a problem. Because I would want, you know, I'd want you to be able to feel good about yourself and the world no matter what.
Well, I do. I really do. I mean, I'm not trying to paint myself as someone where if I don't have a, you know, a barbell in my hands, I'm, you know, turning to the crack pipe. It's really more just like, hey, the gym is nice. I like getting there because it feels good to be there and I feel good afterwards. And if I don't go, it's not the end of the world, but I'd rather go than not go.
Well, and also just, you didn't ask this question, but it occurs to me that, because I kind of heard the question that you weren't asking, which was, you know, is it obsessive to go to the gym 6 days a week? And as with anything, again, this is not a question you asked, so I'm answering a question you didn't ask. Bear with me. It depends on the motivation. Like, if you're motivated by, I have to go to the gym 6 days a week or else I'm just going to fall apart and be, like, you know, out of shape and it's going to be horrible, and you have to slave drive yourself to make yourself go, and you're motivated by fear and self-torture, that is not good. But when you say, you know what, I really like how I feel, it just sort of relieves the stress of the day, I love going to the gym because of that, then that's a different kind of motivation. And, mm-hmm. you know, all things being equal, that's pretty good. Better
right.
than a lot of other
I'm
things people do.
Yeah. Hmm? Yeah, I'm definitely more in that. I'll have my days where not going to the gym just really makes me feel just sort of, like I said, sloth-like. But for the most part, it's just, oh, going there just feels... That's my glass of wine at the end of the evening.
And probably and a lot healthier than a glass of wine.
I heard wine has good health benefits, so, you know, if that's your drug of choice, that's not a bad one.
Hey, I think as long as it's legal and not bad for you, it's all good.
I agree.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for another interesting question. I hope that I answered it, you know, comprehensively.
You did. And also, it's always nice just to talk it out, so I really appreciate it.
Well, you are very welcome, and please feel free to call me back and let me know how it's going, or if you have any questions, I look forward to hearing them.
Oh, you know I will.
Great. Then I will talk to you soon.
Thanks so much.
All right. Bye. Always interesting to talk to Brian from Chicago. So I was talking about the fallacy of fairness, and I have to say I want to leave this one out because I truly want to believe that there is fairness in the world. I truly want to believe that if you do the right thing, then bad things won't happen to you. or if you do the wrong thing, then that karma exists and something bad will you'll get your you know you'll get what you deserve. Unfortunately, we do not live in that world because bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. And so I guess that in dealing with the fallacy of fairness, we just have to sort of wrap our minds around that reality and just do the best that we can do. Even though, like I say, ooh, for me, that's a tough one. There's another fallacy called fallacy of change, and it involves expecting others to change if we just encourage them enough or pressure them enough. And this distortion is commonly accompanied by the belief that our happiness and success rests on other people or the other people's ways of thinking of us. So it leads us to believe that forcing other people to change is the only way for us to be happy. For example, if... a husband who thinks, if I just encourage my wife to stop doing the things that irritate me, I'll be happier in this marriage. I'll be a better husband. I'll be a happier person. That's the fallacy of change. But mostly it's that sense of, if I just tell them 27 different ways why they should do something differently, they'll actually change. that's the fallacy part. And people are often on the receiving end of this fallacy of change with well-meaning loved ones who talk to them about their weight. You know, they'll say things like, you know, oh, do you really think you should eat that? Or, hey, I heard that eating that is kind of bad for you. Or, I mean, they try every which way to try to get people to change their eating habits, right? Or stop binging or whatever is going on. And they're exhibiting the fallacy of change, that if you just say, oh, hey, you know, you know, if you eat that's not healthy. If you find all different ways to say that one of these days the person's going to wake up and go, oh my gosh, you're right, it's not healthy. I shouldn't eat this. I'm going to put it down. Forget this. It's never going to happen, because it doesn't matter how many times you try to encourage someone to change or pressure someone into change. That person is not going to change unless they're motivated themselves. And there may be a motivation for them to not change. Then there's the cognitive distortion of always being right. I'm not sure that's the distortion. That might be the outcome. So perfectionists and people who have sort of that imposter syndrome will recognize this distortion. It is the belief that we always must be right, correct, or accurate. With this distortion, the idea that we could be wrong is absolutely unacceptable. And we will fight to the death to prove that we are right. Why am I putting myself in there? Not we, they. With this distortion, the idea that people could be wrong is absolutely unacceptable. They will fight to the death to prove that they are right. I mean, you see this all the time in politics right now, where there's no, hey, agree to disagree. There's just right. I'm right. I'm right. I'm right. You're wrong. It's like there's no such thing as a difference of opinion. It's an intellectual battle that must be won at all costs. I remember... Okay, I'm just going to kind of throw my father under the bus right now a little bit. I remember when I was in college and I was studying, studying economic theory. God knows why. And I came home for the weekend and I was talking to my dad about economic theory, and he's like, no. And then he's like, no, that's incorrect. And then he proceeds to tell me economic theory from 30 years before. And I said, that economic theory is from 30 years ago. It's no longer seen that way. Things have evolved. And he was just like, nope, you're wrong. And I'm like, it's not me, it's my professor. Like, what are you saying? He's like, nope, you're wrong. You're absolutely wrong. My father cannot be wrong. He always has to be right. So he definitely has that particular distortion down pat. But he has lots of other very good qualities, so I forgive him. Okay, then we have the heaven's reward fallacy. The heaven's reward fallacy manifests as a belief that your struggle, your suffering, and your hard work will result in a just reward. I mean, it's pretty much tied to the fallacy of fairness. So it's, you know, It's a fallacy, though. I mean, think about just in your own life and in the lives of people you know. Think about all the times where hard work and sacrifice did not pay off. Sometimes no matter how hard we work or how much we sacrifice, we do not achieve what we hope to achieve. And it's pretty devastating, and we've got to deal with it and grieve it and mourn it. But to think that, hey, I'm not getting my just reward is a potentially damaging pattern of thought, because it just results in disappointment, frustration, anger, even depression when that awaited reward does not materialize. And then we're in the, hey, the world is unfair. How could this be? So I just gave you a lot of cognitive distortions, 16 of them, actually. And I hope you've found them interesting and that you will ponder them, because when you hear the one that particularly resonates with you and think about how it impacts your life and your worldview and your view of yourself, you'll be able to maybe come up with an alternate way of thinking of things. You know, and when you have that alternate way of thinking of things, which is in that rainbow of color between black and white, you can feel more relaxed in the world, better about yourself. And when you feel better and more relaxed, you are less likely to use food to cope. So in other words, change your thoughts, change your life. Okay, here is a question. Actually, it is more of a comment. It's from Janine in Kentucky. She says, when you were talking about binge eating last week and the role of the inner critic in binging, you used a courtroom analogy to help us challenge our inner critic. And then you started to talk about another analogy having to do with a car. But you were interrupted by a caller and you never got back to your point. This happens a lot. Ouch! So true, though. You also didn't finish going over the steps to self-esteem from a couple of weeks ago. Could you please elaborate on one or both of these? No criticism intended. Just want to know more. Love your show. Janine from Kentucky. You know, Janine, you're absolutely right. I do have a tendency to start talking about things and then I get a call and then I don't go back to, or I go back to and don't complete what I was talking about. But if you listen to the show enough, believe me, I talk about things over and over again, because in this kind of way of creating change, repetition is crucial. So you got to hear things over and over and over and over again. But Janine, no criticism taken. You are absolutely right. So I will finish the car analogy. Maybe I have time to do that today. We have about 10 more minutes left in the show. And I will talk about the path to self-esteem either next week or at some point in the near future. Okay, so the car analogy. What she's talking about is the idea that when it comes to your relationship with food, it might seem as if you're in the passenger seat, sitting helplessly by while the driver decides to eat the kitchen. The driver takes you where you don't want to go. So we want to identify what is driving the behavior of binge eating. And I'm going to give you some steps to change that you can implement right away. So for starters, imagine yourself as a car. Now, if this seems a little bit weird, think about this. We refer to car bodies. Why is that? We take our cars to the body shop for repairs. So it's really not that outlandish. So think of yourself as a car. And as you travel on the proverbial road of life, keep in mind that you are not alone in the vehicle. There are usually three basic parts to all of us: the self, the critic, and the soother supporter. So the self is the part of you that has needs, wants, wishes, emotions, and conflicts. When you say, oh, I feel mad, sad, glad, afraid, anxious, worried, hopeful, you know, that's your self talking. The critic informs you of all your perceived transgressions. It is relentlessly judgmental, critical, and sometimes downright nasty. By the way, here's a hint. If you refer to yourself in the second person, that is usually the critic talking. As when you say to yourself, oh, you have no willpower, instead of I have no willpower, which is first person, if you say, oh, you have no willpower, that's usually the critic. The soother supporter is the part that gives you understanding, soothing, and support. And often, that's the part that shows up for other people, but not for you. You are probably very nice and supportive and kind to other people, but when it comes to yourself, it's a different story. So which of those is in the driver's seat? I'm going to take a wild guess and say it's the critic. Now, we all need a little bit of an inner critic to make sure we keep making good choices, but ideally that critic should stay in the back seat, or better yet, the trunk. If you have a trunk in your car, it should be way back there. When the critic is behind the wheel, it isn't pretty. And for many people, the critic strikes exactly when they need the most support. And that leads to using food for support and comfort and distraction. And then that critic is there again to judge you. How could you have eaten that? Oh, you failed again. And the cycle continues. So if you speak to yourself in a critical way, you're going to feel bad. And if you don't soothe and support yourself with dialogue, with words, you're more likely to use food for comfort. So where is the supporter when you feel bad? It's probably mute. It's silent. It's absent. So here's what to do. Step one, recognize who's driving. Who's driving this critic? Does your internal critic remind you of anyone you know? Ask yourself who spoke to you in that way, or who spoke to other people in that way that you overheard? Where did you learn to relate to yourself in this way? Because I guarantee you learned how to be critical of yourself. And there are two ways people learn to be critical. It means either that you heard you were criticized or saw others being criticized, and now you've internalized that voice and turned it against you, or you did not have enough sort of containment or boundaries in your life. Everything was too loose, and that feels unsafe, not enough structure. And when kids don't have enough structure, they create structure. They create these really mean inner critics. So it's likely one of those two things. So ask yourself, you know, is that mean voice really you? Would you say that to anybody else? If you wouldn't say it to anybody else, it's not you. It's somebody else, a parent, a sibling, a teacher, a grandparent, someone in your life. So when you identify the source of that inner critic, tell it, shh, shush. It no longer has permission to drive you crazy. Banish it to the back seat. Step two is be a friend to yourself. Be a supporter of yourself. Think about how you express support for other people. I'm going to bet that you are caring, understanding, helpful, maybe friendly. Now, what if you spoke to yourself the way you speak to others? Try it. Just try it. Even if it feels awkward, even if it feels weird, even if it feels sort of made up and forced, do it. Practice makes progress. Fake it till you make it. You will see a difference, I promise you. Talk to yourself as if you were someone you love. Be nice to yourself. You will feel better. And when you feel supported and soothed by yourself, to yourself, you are way less likely to eat for soothing and to eat for support. When you are driven by a wish to be supportive and understanding to yourself as well as to others, you will stop using food to cope. Another key is to be curious and not critical. Oh, just one more thing. When you're a friend to yourself, be sure to watch the tone, right? Because you could say, oh, it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. It's not going to last this way. I'm going to feel better. You know, that maybe feels a little soothing. But if you say, it's going to be okay, you're not going to feel this way forever. Not so much. So tone is very, 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 very important. The next thing, which is to be curious, not critical. I'm going to talk more about this next week. Janine, if you're listening, I'm going to finish talking about this next week. But it is generally to look at the way you think and how that impacts the way you feel, which in turn impacts what you do. So if you think, oh, I can't believe I ate so much cake. I am never going to lose weight. I have no willpower. I hate myself. Then how are you going to feel? And by the way, which cognitive distortions do you recognize in that way of thinking? Well, if you say that to yourself, you are not going to feel all warm and fuzzy. You are not going to be happy. You will feel terrible. Then you're going to turn to food. Then you're going to make yourself feel bad. then the cycle is going to repeat. So we're going to talk more about being curious, not critical, next week. That's our show for today. Thank you so much for being here. I'm here every Wednesday here at LA Talk Radio. You can listen live at 10 a.m. Wednesdays or listen later on iTunes, Google Play, or anywhere that you can hear podcasts. And if you want more information about me, if you want any free downloads or want information on my Kick the Diet Habit online program, you can find all those resources at my website, winthedietwar.com. Winthedietwar.com. Check it out. I've got lots of downloads and giveaways and lots of food for thought. Thanks again. I'll see you next week.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.